Aura TV, the world is thinking.
Thank you all for coming, and thank you to the Albert Ellis Institute. And first of all, just before we start, we are filming this event, or rather Fora TV are filming this event. So the fact that you stay, you're giving your consent to be filmed. So if anybody doesn't want to be a movie star, now's your time to leave. A recording of the meeting will be on our website shortly. It will also be on the website of Fora TV and Reason TV. So this is a topic that's very, very much on everybody's mind. And what we're hoping to do in the discussion today with the panel and with the audience is just look to the extent to which human behavior is determined by genetic influences, by the environment, or even if there are some outside influences that you might not necessarily attribute to those two things. And I think as well in the discussion, what we want to do is to look at the consequences of, you know, whether or not you think we are completely determined by our genes or not. Whatever your point of view, what are the consequences for our understanding of human behavior? And I think another important part of the discussion would be to look at what is specific about now, because this is, you know, very, very much a topic that's on everybody's mind. You know, every day there's something in the press, it's on the TV, there are meetings right across New York, you know, on this topic. But I think it'll be interesting to look at what's specific about today that means this is very much on everybody's mind. And even on the travel radio this morning, they were saying that if anybody's looking for a career change, research into DNA is evidently an expanding field. So those of you that you know, maybe looking for a new job, then I'm sure it's not that difficult to get into. I say that tongue in cheek, because obviously it is. And I suppose, you know, ultimately what we're looking at in this discussion is what does it mean to be human? What is it that's special about our humanity, you know, for us as people and the type of society that we want to live in? So, without further ado, I'm going to introduce the speakers, but just before I do, one thing to bear in mind during the course of the discussion is the way this is going to work is the speakers are all going to speak for 7 minutes each, and I do have my stopwatch here and some nice signs to keep them on task. And then we're going to take it out to the audience for a round of questions. Then the speakers will come back. Then we'll come back out to the audience, because one of our briefs is to maximize the amount of audience participation in the discussion. So we want this really to be a dialogue between the panel members and also between the panel and the audience. So when you speak, you need to be concise so that we can get everybody in, but you don't have to try and frame your point in a question. If you've got something to say, then, you know, please just say it. And another thing to bear in mind is we're assuming that everybody here is an adult and can handle the fact that some people might not agree with what you say, and some people may say things that you don't agree with. If you find that a difficult thing to handle, then once again, now's the time to leave. But I'm assuming that you all are adults, and you're not all going to, you know, have a strop just because, you know, maybe you disagree with something that David says, or he disagrees with something that you've said. Because the only way we can really come to an understanding of these things is if we have a very, you know, a discussion that really tries to interrogate the ideas, and we don't worry too much about people's feelings. But of course, no bad language is allowed when I'm moderating. Okay, so I'm going to introduce the speakers one at a time. First of all, to my left, in many ways, is Ron Bailey. Ron Bailey, and you can obviously read the full profiles of the speakers on our website. Ron Bailey is the award-winning science correspondent for Reason Magazine and Reason.com. And also the author of the book Liberation Biology, The Moral and Scientific Case for the Biotech Revolution. He also has written for Forbes, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and many, many other publications, and spoken on numerous television and radio programs. Then next to me on my immediate left is David Schenck, who is the national best-selling author of 5 previous books, and his most recent book is available upstairs. And there will be a reception at the end of this meeting upstairs, where you'll be able to get a copy of David's book. The copies you get won't be as big as this. I have the manuscript. But his book is The Genius in All of Us. And full disclosure, anybody who starts a book talking about Ted Williams, who played baseball for the Boston Red Sox, one of the greatest baseball players of all time, has my attention. David has also written very extensively and published many books. Then next to me on my right is Christine Doyle, who is the Associate Executive Director of the Albert Ellis Institute. She's also the Director of Clinical Services and Director of Child and Family Services at the Ellis Institute and an Adjunct Assistant Professor at St. John's University. She's conducted, you know, many seminars and workshops and given numerous presentations both nationally and internationally on rational emotive behavior therapy. And you can read Christine's full profile on our website. And finally, on my far right is Stuart Derbyshire, who's actually just been promoted to Associate Professor at the University of Birmingham in the United Kingdom. Congratulations, Stuart. His lab is focused on the interrelationship between biology and psychology. His main interest is in pain as a particularly tricky example of how the interface of biology and experience can be much less obvious than it seems. He's also written extensively on fetal pain, consciousness, genetics, ethics, shopping, and economics. So please give a round of applause for our speakers. So without further ado, Ron has actually volunteered to go first. I'm going to hand this microphone over to Ron.
Okay, it's very lovely. First of all, thank you, Jean, and thank you, New York Salon and the Institute for inviting me to be here. I'm a journalist and a someone who is something of an outsider, and I will be reporting only a little bit of what I think I've learned over the years in this particular area. And reading over the bios of my fellow panelists, I was shocked to discover that I may be the person who is most inclined toward genetic determinism, which I found a little bit disturbing. But let's see how this plays out here. First of all, let's start out. Of course, it's not nature or nurture. It's both. Everybody knows that. All the panelists here do. The biologists are agreeing with that. However, it is the case that genetic variations do tell us things about ourselves. Genes are machines for taking inputs from the environment and turning them into proteins as outputs. However, gene machines and combinations of gene machines do vary between people. Each of us bears hundreds of thousands of single nucleotide polymorphisms that distinguish our genetic makeup from that of other people. That's why we look differently. This means that given certain environmental inputs, the outputs will also tend to vary. Now, the main thing that people worry about is not the fact that we all learn language kind of the same way, that we all walk on 2 feet and we have, you know, hearts or whatever. They worry about behavioral outputs. They're worried that some people may be smarter, more aggressive, happier, more likely to be heterosexual, more prone to believe in God, and so forth. We worry about the effects that genes may have on behavioral outputs because some people fear that this variance implies permanent social and economic inequalities, so-called genetic determinism. Well, let's take a brief look at some very preliminary research into behavioral genetics. And again, I'm not a scientist. I'm reporting what I've dug up and what I've talked to people about. It turns out a lot of research on genetic component of human behavior implicate the processing of the neurohormone dopamine in the brain. Dopamine is commonly associated with the pleasure system of the brain, providing feelings of enjoyment and reinforcement to motivate a person proactively to perform certain activities. In its good mode, it helps us to learn. In its bad mode, it may be implicated with addiction and addictive behaviors. So what have some researchers found? The research literature is filled with studies evaluating the effect of elevated levels of dopamine and norepinephrine, which are associated with impulsivity and violence. And I would suggest to you that those are endpoints that are of interest, but they're also easier to measure because we have something called CORTS. that look at people. So that is a behavioral input that's something we can look at. For example, the gene for, I'm not sure I'm going to get this right, CMOT, comes in two varieties, one of which is four times slower in breaking down dopamine and norepinephrine. Studies indicate that people with the slow version of this gene are more prone to violence. Then there's monoamine oxidase A, which is another brain enzyme that inactivates dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin. It also comes in two versions. A study in New Zealand found that men who carried the low activity version and who had been reared in abusive households were nine times more likely to commit crimes and to be violent. And in fact, the ones who were in the most abusive households, 85% of them had been convicted of violent crimes. On the other hand, men who carried the low activity version and who were reared by supportive parents were no more violent or aggressive than men bearing the higher activity version. In other words, the environmental input prevented them from succumbing to whatever the risk was of this particular version of the gene. But even interestingly, men who had been maltreated as kids but who carried the high activity version of the gene were no more likely to be engaged in antisocial behavior than those who had suffered no abuse at all. And one researcher suggested, we have identified a gene that seems to protect children from the harmful effects of maltreatment. The researchers explicitly noted, and this is where I'm going to get to later, these findings could inform the development of future pharmacological treatments. Another example, combining one variant of the dopamine transporter gene, specifically the VNTR polymorphism, you don't have to remember all this, with the environmental input of paternal alcoholism is strongly correlated to serious alcohol problems. This was based on data from the National Longitudinal Study on Adolescent Health, which found that the DAT polymorphism interacted with paternal alcoholism to predict serious alcohol problems among males. Specifically, this is a repeat allele, which we don't need to go into, but it increased alcohol problems only among males who had an alcoholic father. On the other hand, the allele was unrelated to alcohol problems for males without an alcoholic father. In other words, again, you can have the right environmental input and you won't get the higher risk. So where does this might lead us to? In Anthony Burgess' novel, A Clockwork Orange, the imprisoned teenage murderer and rapist Alex undergoes the fictional Ludovico technique. As you'll recall, the Ludovico technique is an aversive treatment in which prisoner patients were forced to watch violent scenes while being made severely nauseated by means of injections. Eager to get out of prison at any cost, Alex lies to the prison chaplain that he's volunteering for the Ludovico technique because, quote, I just want to be good. The chaplain tries to talk him out of it, arguing the question is whether or not this technique really makes a man good. Goodness comes from within. Goodness is chosen. When a man cannot choose, he ceases to be a man. But could Alex, the sociopath, really choose goodness? As neuroscience advances, I think it will increasingly appear that goodness is the proper balance of neurochemicals acting in appropriate neural circuits. Right now, the balance of neurochemicals that makes it possible for one to choose goodness is generally brought about by good parenting, schooling, and proper socialization. The question that will increasingly confront us is whether or not effective neuropharmaceuticals are just another way for us to enable the choosing of goodness. More happily, of course, the good news is that new genetic technologies, chiefly diagnostics and drugs, for now are also enabling people to take greater control over their own lives in disease categories. For example, SSRIs, serotonin reuptake drugs, do not limit people's choices. I think they give depressed people the freedom to adjust their emotional state to one that they would prefer. So finally, and I am finished, and finally, see how that works? Finally, to whatever extent we were ever at the mercy of our genes and biological evolution, we no longer are. Instead, because of our increasing knowledge in biotechnology and medicine, I believe our genes are now at the mercy of our brains. Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Just pass the mic. Christine Doyle.
Okay, thank you. So my points are coming from the perspective of rational emotive behavior therapy, which is the original form of cognitive behavior therapy, what we practice here at the Albert Ellis Institute. When people come to my office, they do so partly because of their genetic makeup. But equally important, in my opinion, they also come because of the choices that they make and how they want to react to events. In the first century AD, the Stoic philosopher Epictetus stated, "Men are disturbed not by things, but by the views which they take." This is the essence of cognitive behavior therapy. I won't argue with the idea that many of our behaviors and emotions, such as anxiety, depression, perhaps alcoholism, and maybe even anger, are influenced by our genetic composition. However, as a cognitive behavioral therapist, I hesitate to stop the train there. Research has shown that although many individuals may have a genetic predisposition towards mental illness, they can be helped significantly with evidence-based treatments such as cognitive behavior therapy. There can be a danger to the idea of behavior genetics. If interpreted in a distorted way, people can walk around and blame their socially maladaptive behaviors on their genes. Sorry, Stuart. I have bad genes. For me, this is much like the days of Freud, when the blame for people's neuroses then was on cold mommy and distant daddy. And frankly, it scares me. My position is that regardless of one's genetic predispositions, there needs to be accountability for one's actions. Coughing up a behavior or a trait or a condition to purely genes, one, implies causation, which is next to impossible to prove, and it also abdicates people of responsibility of their thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. I'd like to do a quick demonstration with you. I'm going to ask that everybody in the room he said he liked pain. Okay, all right. I want everybody in the room to think of a secret that they've never shared with anybody, not even their best friend, something that they're ashamed of. The secret could involve an action you feel ashamed about, or perhaps some personal weakness. Continue to think about it, because in a moment, I'm going to walk around and I'm going to point at someone. And that person is going to have to get up in the center of the room and share their secret with the group. So everybody think about this secret. Okay. What were some of the feelings you had? I imagine some. Obviously, this is a demonstration, but if this were a workshop and you didn't know I was kidding, some would probably have anxiety. Others of you may have anger. And others, oddly, may have been excited about sharing a secret. So what were you thinking when you heard that I was going to ask you to share a secret you never shared before? For those of you who felt anxious, you probably were catastrophizing about the idea of getting up in front of people you don't know and sharing something that you're ashamed about. If you were angry, you were probably thinking something like, how dare this woman come in here and ask us to do this? Who does she think she is? And for any of you that were excited, I'll talk to you after this and we can set up an appointment. Okay, so what's the point of this exercise? We largely create how we feel by the things that we tell ourselves. If it were strictly the event that created our feelings, everybody in the room would have experienced the same reaction, which is not the case. So even if some of you have some genetic pull towards, let's say, anxiety, you can change your anxiety by challenging the way you think. We don't have control over our genes, but we do have control over our thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. I have mixed feelings about some of the consequences of behavioral genetic determinism. So on the one hand, if we talk about, let's say, homosexuality, If a genetic link is determined or discovered, that might alleviate some of the shame that some gay and lesbian individuals experience. It might also reduce the number of phone calls that I get from intolerant parents asking if I can fix their child who is choosing to be gay. On the other hand, it could also ostracize homosexuals to the extent that others view them as abnormal. If we take alcoholism as another example, identifying a gene may drive a variety of reactions. If I have a gene for alcoholism and I choose to drink, how are others around me going to react? Angry? Anxious? Concerned? Disappointed? And if I have the gene, why not drink? I'm Irish. We drink. It's hopeless. It's in our genes. On the other hand, you might feel sympathy for me if I have the gene. Poor Christine. She's 100% Irish. She never had a chance. What I want to emphasize is the point that acknowledging a genetic component, in this case for alcoholism, might inform my subsequent behaviors and actions. It then may lead me to examine and challenge some of my cognitions that tend to drive my drinking. But it also may have the opposite impact and give me an excuse to drink. And finally, let's talk depression. Someone inherits the gene for depression. My concern, again, about this misuse of the idea of genetic determinism is that some will engage in the self-fulfilling prophecy and resign themselves to their genes. This was a term coined by Robert Merton, a 20th century sociologist. The word prophecy in the modern sense has neither false nor true value, but it's just a possibility that is made into a probability by a person's unconscious or conscious actions. So some of these people become like that woman in the Abilify commercial, the woman in the sweatpants that's sitting on the couch, hunched over, ignoring her dog, and then you see her in the grocery store, walking aimlessly with no food in her cart. I want people to know that genes play a part, but the environment has influence as well. And more importantly, we can change the way we think to influence our emotions and behaviors. My bottom line, genes may be a partial explanation, and it definitely, genes are a partial explanation, but don't make them an excuse.
Thank you, Christine. David, and just to remind everybody, David's book, available upstairs.
Why don't we just sell the book now and get it over with? Well, I think I should start by acknowledging that I did rob a bank when I was 5 years old, and some people were killed, and a lot of secrets. Thank you to Gene and the New York Salon folks for having me here. It's an honor to be here. I want to drill down a little deeper on what something that Ron touched on at the beginning of his talk, which is this idea that, as everyone knows, it's not nature or nurture, it's both. Because after 3 years of looking at this question myself and writing this book about it, I'm pretty convinced that that's in itself an awkward and terribly misleading way to understand genes. And I think some of the words we're using, while well-meaning, are kind of a halfway house to the words and phrases that we need to come up with, the metaphors we need to come up with to really understand how genes work. Most scientists have a 21st century way of understanding genes, which I'll get to in a second. The general public is laboring under a late 19th or early 20th century understanding of genes. The key thing is this. Genes are not blueprints that have specific information that detail what a trait is going to look like in that person. That's what we were taught. We were all taught that, that Gregor Mendel discovered genes, although he didn't use that word, but basically discovered the concept of genes by breeding these pea plants. That those experiments did happen. I'm not saying that didn't happen. But they were so simple, and the people in the kind of the first generation of genetics were relying on science that was so simple, and I don't mean to put it down, but so basic, that they took from those experiments and experiments that followed this idea that genes create traits. And that's not what genes do. Genes interact with our environment. So to say that it's not nature, to say that it's nature and nurture gives the impression that nature gives us a little bit of our intelligence and our musical ability and our this and that, and then nurture comes along and gives us the rest of it, that it's kind of one and then the other. When in fact, everything that we do and everything we are is an interaction, a dynamic interaction between genes and the environment. So instead of thinking of genes as blueprints with this specific information about what color an eye is going to be or how tall a person's going to be or whether a person's going to be musical or angry or what have you. Think of genes as a giant control board of switches and knobs that get turned on and off, that not only can get turned on and off, but are getting turned on, constantly from the first moment of conception to the last breath you take. So when we use a word like predisposition, genetic predisposition, what does that mean? It means that they've discovered a gene or a set of genes that if a person that in a certain population, the people that as Ron was referring to, the people in this population that have this certain gene or set of genes are 75% likely to be bald or to abuse their spouses or what have you. But 25% of those people aren't. So we put on this label, well, so those people with the gene are supposedly predisposed by the genes. I'm going to object to that, to the use of that word. It's true that in the environment that, or in the combination of environments that are going on with that particular population, those percentages are taking place. That doesn't really tell us what that gene is and what it's going to say. We have so much more to learn, about what's in each of these particular genes and how they're going to react and interact with the environment. And of course, we're not going to learn, we're never going to learn at all, but this whole idea of predisposition, I think, it's useful when we're making policy, it's useful for insurance agents, it's useful when we learn a few interesting things that Ron says, you know, a few examples that Ron gave about maybe modifying our behavior this way or that way. But fundamentally, we need to have, I'm proposing that we in the general public need to have a more nuanced understanding of genes. It's closer to what scientists have. I also, and I think this should be obvious now, am arguing we need to throw out completely terms like innate and inborn, because that really doesn't exist. I mean, it really doesn't exist. In some cases, there are specific genes that almost always lead to certain traits. But even in those cases, there is a dynamic interaction going on. And I should backtrack and repeat what Ron said about himself and say it's also true for me. I'm not a scientist. I'm not pretending to be one. I am really speaking on behalf of a number of scientists who are, to me, on the cutting edge, not just of understanding this dynamic interaction, but of trying to articulate it in a new and forceful way so that we can hopefully educate the public about it. So how much more time do I have? 1 minute. All right, with my 1 minute, I'm gonna say that by saying that it's all about gene environment interaction, and by saying that we need to walk away from any sort of idea of genetic determinism, I am not saying that we have control over our lives. The notion that if we say that something is not gene-based, that it's over in the nurture category, and therefore we should be able to control it, and if we don't do a good job as parents, we screwed up, and so forth. We inherit so many things. We inherit so much about our environment, and there's so many things that we just don't have control over. What my book is about, and what I think this ongoing conversation about dynamic interaction has to be about, is not putting the burden of control on all of us because it's all nurture or anything like that, but of understanding it just a little bit better and maybe getting this much more control over our lives. And I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks very much. Thanks to advances in genomics, we know now that there are about 20,000 functional genes in the human genome, which is actually not a very large number. If you type genes determine into Google, you'll get something like 13.5 million hits. Of course, some of those hits will be broken, some of those hits will be non-existent, but nevertheless, it seems like there's some incongruence between the number of genes and the number of hits in Google. There aren't enough genes to determine all that behavior. Fair enough, you might say, but there aren't an awful lot of letters in the alphabet either. We managed to generate an awful lot of words. So maybe it's not the number of genes, but it's what they do. And one of the things that they do is they build the brain. The brain has 10 billion neurons that form 10 trillion connections. That sounds like a better basis for understanding human behavior. But if you divide the number of connections with the number of neurons, you arrive at the number of connections made by each single neuron, which is just 1,000. And that's a rather low number again. And what that low number demonstrates is that the brain is organized as a collection of small local circuits that form areas of specialized activity. And there are a lot fewer areas of specialized activity than 1,000. Nevertheless, type brain's cores into Google and you'll get just over 8 million hits. Again, something seems incongruent. Unless we're being ridiculously generous, and I don't think we owe geneticists or neuroscientists any generosity whatsoever, neurogenetics appears to offer a base that is simply too narrow to balance all that behavior. So there must be something wrong with the way that geneticists and neuroscientists understand behavior. Another thing that draws me to the conclusion that neurogeneticists misunderstand human beings is that they draw some really odd conclusions. Many geneticists and neuroscientists are surprisingly ambivalent about whether or not they control their own minds and whether or not they can make their own choices. This strikes me, and I imagine it's not just me, as fairly odd, maybe even a bit balmy. It's evident that we have freedom because we built and changed the world to fit our interests and desires. We can, at least in the developed world, avoid hunger, cold, and disease, and so forth. It is precisely and only free agents that can bring about the kinds of changes in the world to prevent these things. The world we inhabit provides indisputable evidence of the reality of human agency. The development of medicine, industry, transportation, communication, clean water, a stable food supply, warm habitats, and so on, do rather speak for themselves. The case is closed. And psychologists, neuroscientists, philosophers who doubt human agency and freedom should probably just try and get out a bit more. The people disputing free will and agency have reached, I think, crazy conclusions. And for that basis, we should reject their science. But they're not actually crazy. There's a reason why they're making the conclusions that they're making. And that reason is basically they have a remarkably deterministic understanding of what human beings are. In outline, the argument is that human beings are the product of physical processes in the brain that are either innate or generated by environmental inputs, including family structure and culture. Every physical event has a cause, and what goes on in the brain and body is caused by preceding states of the brain and body. Human behavior is thus fully determined by factors that we cannot change, brain chemistry and our personal history. Consequently, there is no free will or agency, and consciousness is merely an illusory product of our brains. It's a seductive conclusion. But I'm going to argue that it's incorrect. And I'm going to argue that the fact that contemporary neuroscience brings us to this conclusion merely demonstrates the paucity of contemporary neuroscience. I'm undoubtedly going to run out of time, but if you take away just one thing from my talk, it's this. The denial of free will and agency by contemporary neuroscience only serves to highlight the degeneracy of contemporary neuroscience. Unless neuroscience starts to take free will and agency seriously, then neuroscience deserves the same kind of contempt that most of us reserve for creationists. And I really mean that. And I speak as a neuroscientist. The challenge for neuroscience is to try and understand the relationship between constraint and freedom, to understand how human beings escaped from the dictates of nature-nurture interactions, and to understand why it is a mistake to locate free will and agency inside our brains or inside our genes. Neuroscientists reach the conclusion that free will and agency are illusory because they're looking in the wrong place. To untangle this muddle, we've got to begin with something that almost everybody agrees on. It is the case that the brain does all kinds of things that we're not aware of. As chuck a ball up in the air and catch it, your brain will do all sorts of differential equations that you won't be the slightest bit aware of. Do something mundane, like reach out and grab a glass. Your brain will accelerate your hand. Open the hand sufficient to grab the glass. Decelerate your hand so that you don't knock the glass over. Grip the glass sufficiently to hold it firmly, but without shattering it. Accelerate the glass from its resting place towards your mouth, and then decelerate it so that you can drink from it and not spill it down your front. Although your brain will do all of that, you'll be barely aware of anything except the goal of drinking from the glass. The brain performs calculations and makes decisions all the time, even to the point of constructing what the world will look like. So in the famous Ames room, for example, people look impossibly tall at one end and impossibly short at the other. And if a person walks from one end of the Ames room to the other, they will look like they shrink or grow. This illusion occurs because the room narrows at one end, but your brain assumes that the room is a fixed size, and consequently you see people shrink or grow, depending on where they stand in the room. This trick's pulled off in the Willy Wonka movie, which is where you might have seen it. Lots of troubling questions flow from these assumptions made by our brain, which can be summarized as, to what extent are we free and the outside world real if our brains are making assumptions on our behalf? Given that the brain hides the inferences it makes and filters the sensations we receive, does that mean that our brains create an illusory world that is isolated and independent of the world as it truly is? It is certainly an unsettling question, but it's not one that demands that we accept human agency, freedom, consciousness, and so forth as epiphenomena. There are a number of muddles to sort out. I'm just going to give you two. First, it's true that we don't have direct access to the world, and it's also true that the world is not parceled up into readily consumable fact-sized chunks. The fact that apples grow on trees is created by us via a relationship with apple trees. The independent units that we recognize in the world as apples are the products of our perspectives as well as the products of nature. Facts are made explicit by conscious beings, that is, you. They do not exist in themselves. So yes, our facts are interpretations of the world as we find it. This can lead to all sorts of irritating arguments about whether or not the world really exists and so on and so forth. To cut through this, it's necessary to recognize that facts are made by conscious agents, but they're not made up. They are grounded in a real relationship between us and the environment. And that relationship is not illusory, even though it may involve a blend of conscious awareness, language, and the way things are out there that is not entirely trustworthy. The point is, and this is where I'll have to end, even though I'm barely a third of the way through, is that it is in the relationship between you and the world that consciousness exists. And it's the same kind of relationship that many other animals have too, but human beings have this in a particularly special way. You cannot find the relationship between you and apple trees in neurons, because neurons don't know anything at all about apple trees. It is only persons that understand what apple trees are. Genes and neurons understand absolutely nothing. So if we locate awareness, experience, and so forth in neurons and in genes, then we make a mistake. And because we make that mistake, experience starts to appear weird, or in this case, it starts to appear like it is illusory.